For the week of February 7th, 2016, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 311, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Oh my God, the Super Bowl. Did you see that? I was not expecting that. I mean, it was what, fourth down, 7-9 to go, and then suddenly CBS pulls an audible and announces the end of The Good Wife. Nobody expected that to happen.
Okay, you do realize that the Super Bowl was really about the game of American football.
No, it's not. It was about the commercials. There were a lot of commercials. Most of them sucked. There was a halftime show. Beyonce took over America, Black Power. And then there was the announcement of the end of The Good Wife, a signature series for CBS. Certainly that's going to be a trivia question in the future. What TV show announced it was ending its run during the Super Bowl? And the only answer so far is The Good Wife, a secret that they let out during the game. That's unbelievable. I mean, how they kept that quiet, I don't know, because someone edited that. And they had to put it in the list of stuff. And, you know, we knew the executive producers, the showrunners were leaving. We knew that the star, Juliana Margulies, was joking, I'm going to be out of work and come April. But they kept the fact that these are the last season and the last nine episodes to come until they could announce it on the Super Bowl. That's using a platform, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think the only other secret was who was going to win the game, which wasn't so much a secret as something
that's
that
not a secret.
Exactly. I mean, you knew that Beyonce was going to show up. You knew Bruno Mars was going to show up at the halftime show.
And all the people making fun of Coldplay, if you look at the history of the Super Bowl halftime show, which really starts, I think, with New Kids on the Block. Before that, it was mostly Up With People and marching bands. Once we had the modern era of the halftime show, it usually involves multiple acts.
Yes, but
most of the time, there are multiple acts on stage. It's not just one act like U2 or Springsteen. That happens too. But a lot of times, you're getting, you know, Madonna and, you know, Nicki Minaj. And, you know, so this is very normal.
Yeah, I think, though, when that happens, it's more like, okay, and it's Madonna and Nicki Minaj is singing with Madonna, not Madonna. And then, oh, by the way, we're going to cut away from Madonna entirely to show you Nicki Minaj for like a minute and a half.
It's just like all the others. Whatever.
Okay, well.
Everybody wants to diss on Coldplay. Whatever.
Yeah, no, I thought Coldplay was fine.
I'm just saying it's not that big a deal.
You know what? It's not time for Big Deal or Big Whoop.
Oh, okay. I'm
not
sorry.
Yet. No, it's time for this week's show, where we will be having a play-by-play breakdown of the Super Bowl. No, of course we won't be doing that. We might mention the halftime show, as we just did, but our worldwide audience can be rest assured we're here to talk about the business of entertainment. Award season remains as confusing as ever, with the Directors Guild handing out its top honor to The Revenant, agreeing with none of the other guilds. What does it mean for the Oscars? No one knows. But we'll take a guess. Time Warner wants to become an investor in the website and streaming service Hulu. But first, they'd like it to stop showing all those TV episodes from the current season.
Or stop being Hulu.
Yeah, I was just going to say, or...
We want to buy Hulu, but we just don't want you to be Hulu.
Correct. We'd like to buy Spotify. We just don't want the music. Maybe they want to buy it so they can shut it down. Who knows? During Inside Baseball, we'll look at the Game of Thrones taking place at Viacom. Winter isn't coming, it's here. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We get our info from Rentrack. We have a link in our show notes to their website. We also look at Variety, Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, you name it, anybody and everyone with box office information. And the number one movie around the world, underperforming but still on top, is Kung Fu Panda 3, another $44 million. It's passing the $200 million mark. It'll be a profitable film for everyone involved, and it's doing great in China, but it is definitely not holding up its end in North America.
Well, I wonder if in North America, people are just, you know, they've, like most sequels, you know, they don't make more money as they go along. I mean, that used to be the case, that they kind of taper off over time. Only recently is it that one sequel after another makes more money. I wonder if that's what's happening here.
That's true. It's a perfectly natural development for the third film in a series. We've just come not to expect that. And given the fact that this has the best reviews of all three and is pretty gorgeous looking and makes good use of 3D, it's a shame that this would be the one that, you know, takes the body blow. And it's a very valuable franchise, and God knows DreamWorks Animation needs that. And it does have, I think it has a TV spinoff, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yeah.
Yeah, it has, you know, obviously merchandise and games and TV. So it's a very important franchise for them. And, you know, they made use of, I pilloried them for moving production to China as they did. But in fact, they made good artistic use of that. You know, for this particular movie, it makes sense. And they actually did not squander that. They made something of it. So it's too bad that the result has not been doing as well at the box office as it might.
At least here in North America.
Well, overall, it's at $200 million. It's I don't think it's going to keep pace with the first two. Like you say, it'll be a natural, you know, slowing down of the box office. And number two around the world is Leonardo DiCaprio's Oscar hopeful The Revenant, another $30 million. It's at $325 million and counting. And number three is a South Korean drama. It's called A Violent Prosecutor. It's about a prosecutor who gets framed for a crime he didn't commit, thrown into jail, and he has to partner up with this nutty, crazy con artist sort of guy in order to clear his name. It opened to $20 million in South Korea, so a great opening for that movie. And number four is Star Wars, The Force Awakens, $13 million over the weekend. And yes, as we said, as everyone noticed, it was about to pass, and it has the $2 billion mark. The third film in history to hit $2 billion.
And think about this, even in the U.S., where it's played for, at least 6 to 7, if not 8 weeks, $6.8 million this week.
Yes, yes. Well, it's December 18th is when it opened, so it's, you know, almost 8 weeks. It's 7 weeks, I guess. It's past $900 million in North America. It's stupid to say a movie that grossed $1 billion overseas has underperformed, but I guess it does show us, boy, this movie really has its heart in North America. I mean, it's obviously hugely popular everywhere, but you can see that if you gross $900 million in the U.S., you would expect to gross, you know, more like $1.8 billion overseas, especially for a movie of this type.
Yeah,
but, you know,
I suppose
$2 billion is nothing to sneer at.
No, not at all. I'll take, you know what, if you're not pleased with that, bring it on over. I'll hold on to it for you.
And number five is Alvin and the Chipmunks 4. This is why we look at the worldwide box office, isn't it?
Well,
I mean, this
okay.
movie is off our radar. We haven't thought about it in ages. It's sort of not done great. And it's not doing great no matter what. But, you know, it's still making money. Here it is. It's in 55 territories. It grossed $13 million over the weekend. And it's hitting $170 million. So it costs $90 million to make. It doesn't look like it's going to get to, $270 million, but it's still making money. And that tells us that ultimately it's not going to lose a lot.
I mean, look at it. It's made $84 million in North America alone.
Well, it should. It costs $90 million to make.
Right.
Right. I mean, you know, you want to make back your budget in the U.S. You want to do better than that. But, you know, there we are. At least we know it's still out there working its little chipmunk butt off to make money. And number six is the Joel and Ethan Coen film Hail Caesar. This looks like one of their misfires. It opened to $11 million over the weekend. A misfire, I say that critically and commercially. Some critics loved it. Some were mixed. Some hated it. But the audiences really seemed to dislike this movie.
Yeah, I don't know why. I mean, I haven't seen it, so because it was screening during Sundance.
I think it's a Joel and Ethan Coen movie, but I think it's just a George Clooney movie for a lot of people. And
okay.
They just went to see the new movie. They didn't think, oh, this is an oddball art house type movie. They just went to see this new comedy and were like, what's this? You know, the people who went to see it because it's a Joel and Ethan Coen movie, I imagine, are more likely to have appreciated it. Those who went to see it just because it looks like a comedy with George Clooney and, isn't Channing Tatum in it?
Yes.
And Scarlett Johansson, yeah. You know, they say, oh, that looks kind of fun. What? What's this? Hollywood Fixer? What? You know, it's only cost $22 million to make. So obviously, this will be a valuable addition to their portfolio. For Universal and for whoever made it and invested in it, it's going to be long-term a movie that they will profit from, but it's certainly not going to be one of their big, not that they're a big commercial force to begin with, right?
No, I mean, certainly they've had movies like Fargo or like No Country for Old Men that do quite well, but then they also have movies like A Serious Man. And which I loved as well, and I'm sure many people don't even know that movie was ever released. Or if they do, they have no idea that it's a Coen Brothers movie. So, I mean, there's a movie that probably didn't make a lot of money. I'm going to go double check while you move on to the next
one. Oh, I'm sure it didn't. I think their biggest hit is True Grit.
Oh, and yeah, that's seven, true. Mm-hmm. Yes, I forgot about
number
that.
Number seven is The Fifth Wave, another $11 million. It's at $84 million and counting. And number eight is Dirty Grandpa, the doorman in the building that I'm staying at today, keeps asking me if they're going to make a Dirty Grandpa sequel. He loved it. He's the only one. I'm like, I don't think De Niro and Efron want to go anywhere near a sequel to Dirty Grandpa. If it made a ton of money, they might thumb their noses at the critics, but I don't think it's going to happen. But it did make $8 million. It's at $46 million worldwide. And number nine is The Hateful Eight, the Quentin Tarantino film. Another $8 million. $115 million worldwide. And I think, Sperling, you pointed out to me, which I didn't know, this apparently is a snuff film.
What? Oh, I know what you're talking about. When,
yeah, it is. Well, first they of all, killed a guitar in the making of this movie, or an actual guitar for the making of this movie, didn't they?
Yes, they did. I mean, certainly a Quentin Tarantino film being a snuff film, you know, maybe fictionally is a snuff film because everybody dies in the end. No spoilers there. But in this case, I guess there's a scene, and it's a one-take scene. It comes at a pivotal moment of the film, right after the intermission.
But you're not revealing anything important.
No. I'm not revealing anything important. Right. Where Jennifer Jason Leigh is playing the guitar, and she plays this guitar, and then Kurt Russell comes over, and you kind of know what he's going to do. He's going to, like, break the guitar into a million pieces, and that's exactly what he does. There's only one problem with that. The guitar was an 1860s Martin guitar. Literally an 1860s Martin guitar.
He had no idea. He thought it was a prop.
Yes.
And she's like, ah! Oh, God, that's just awful. It was apparently from a museum. The Martin people had loaned it to them. Why you would need an act? I mean, I can understand, but oh, my God. You know, what an awful. So, of course, he found out and he was, you know, horrified that he'd done it. But, you know, what are you going to do? It's Martin Guitar has now said, we're not going to loan out museum pieces to anyone ever again.
Yeah.
You know, you can mock up one. Yeah, that would be okay.
I mean, the only reason to do that would be for an authentic sound. That's it, because you could actually remake a guitar from the 1860s down to the width of everything. And, you know, however, what you can't do is age the wood. So, yeah. You know, you actually need to.
But
to
of course,
have,
that won't sound like it did in the 1860s because it's 150 years later. So, you know, you're not getting an authentic sound. You're just getting what a museum piece sounds like 150 years after the time.
Correct.
But anyway, Jennifer Jason Leigh apparently was going to buy the guitar. She didn't know it was a museum piece. She thought it cost $4,000, not $40,000. She's like, oh my God, I love this guitar so much. They let her take it home and practice on it. So she was all into the guitar, and then he grabs it and smashes it. Oh, so if you haven't seen the film, watch that scene and enjoy.
Yes, because it literally is the death of a priceless, $40,000.
Awful, awful.
Now, I'd like to go back to the Coen brothers for just a second. A couple interesting things here. A Serious Man, okay, which is Hail Caesar is being compared to.
No, it's not.
Well,
Hail Caesar is a comic spoof on Hollywood. Serious Man is this dark drama. Who the heck is comparing them?
Just the religious aspects. That's it. Just the religious
aspect. There's a religious aspect in Hail Caesar?
That's what I said. That's exactly what I said. And then, sure enough, I'm reading all these reviews and going, oh, I see. There's all these allusions to it.
I guess I should watch a movie before I talk about it.
Exactly. So, domestically, the film earned $9.2 million.
Wow, A Serious Man.
Yeah, and $22 million overseas for a total of $31.4 million. Okay.
Wow.
And domestically, it never opened on more than 262 screens, so...
You know what its budget was?
That's what I'm trying to find out. But think about it. Here you have Hail Caesar with George Clooney at $22 million.
It's not done yet.
Yeah. Meaning the budget was $22 million.
Oh, sure. And, well, they all did it for fun.
And here you have A Serious Man starring absolutely nobody. I can't imagine that this film cost a lot of money.
Well, but Hail Caesar is a period piece. You know, so that also, it's not Clooney. Those people aren't getting a paycheck to make this movie. You know, they're doing it for fun and for art. Everybody involved is making Hail Caesar for art, not for a paycheck. So, you know, that budget is the budget.
Yes.
You know, so A Serious Man is not a period piece, but I'm sure it costs money. You know, I'm sure it costs $10 million or something.
Yeah, I can't seem to find it anywhere.
Well, we'll see. At number 10 is a French film. It's a comedy. It's called Le Touche Tout. I should have looked up the name. I don't know how to pronounce it, actually. It's about a northern family, a family in the north of France, winning the lottery. Think the Beverly Hillbillies. In the first one, they went to vacation in Monaco. In the second one, the son, or one of the sons, goes to the U.S. to study, and the family comes along and hilarity ensues. It grossed $8 million over the weekend. The Finest Hours is struggling. This movie is not doing well in the U.S. or overseas. Chris Pine is still looking for his success outside those big, big franchise films. $7 million over the weekend, $24 million and counting. Nicholas Sparks opened a movie in North America, 15 territories, but basically North America. It's called The Choice. It costs $10 million to make. It's the latest in a string of Nicholas Sparks movies. They all seem to be profitable. They all are made for a dime and seem to make money. But this one, for whatever reason, is partially financed by Nicholas Sparks himself. I don't know whether he just said, I want to do it, or for some reason people weren't interested. It's gotten poisonously bad reviews, but it opened to $6 million. It'll probably be fine. He'll get his money back. But I wonder why that happened.
I have no idea, but I can answer the following question. The budget for A Serious Man is estimated to be about $7 million.
There you go. So at least based on that, we're looking at a hit.
Yeah, that is why the Coen brothers keep making movies, because they actually make money based on how much they cost.
Right. Well, based on what we know from the budget.
Correct.
And so scrolling all the way down towards the bottom, I want to talk about another film from overseas. It's Dad's Army. Do you know this movie?
Not at all.
Right. This is a classic British sitcom, which I've actually never watched, but I've seen the name for decades. It's always on the list of favorite British sitcoms of all time. I don't know if it's actually good, but it's about the Home Guard during World War II, mostly set in the early part of the war when the Home Guard had something to do. They thought there might be an invasion. And old people, that's the focus in this particular TV show, were, you know, volunteering to stand guard and keep watch. And of course, in small towns and other areas, they just used their authority for silly reasons, and there was no particular threat of Nazis coming over the hill. And so it's a light sitcom about that, you know, period in British history. But you always see references to this show if you follow UK television, and they turned it into a film. This is the second time they've tried to make a film out of it. It didn't turn out well, from what I can gather. It stars Bill Nighy, Toby Jones, Michael Gambon, Catherine Zeta-Jones. I mean, it's an all-star cast. They got every great actor over 60 playing the role of these Home Guard men, and Catherine Zeta-Jones as a reporter. It's set later in the war. People booed the trailer. They booed the trailer because the trailer of the film initially said it's 1944 and England was on the brink of losing the war. And people are like, no, they weren't.
Yeah,
in 1944, they were on the brink of winning the war. D-Day had just begun or was about to begin. Everyone knew the tide had turned for the Nazis. So why are you saying that? So the British people actually booed the trailer for the movie, which I'm sure they yanked and changed immediately because it wasn't important. But this is set in 1944 when there really was no need for the Home Guard. You know, people were not worried about the Nazis invading them. The Nazis were worried about us invading Germany. And it opened to $3 million. So a very sad, squandered opportunity with a lot of great actors. Not that a movie needed to be made of Dad's Army, but it is a TV show I've always wondered about and wanted to catch up on. Maybe it's on Hulu.
Ooh, okay. Well,
we're not there yet. I know.
Okay.
There's another note about Hail Caesar. Let's talk about this. The movie opened to how much money?
$11 million here in the U.S.
$11 million over the weekend. You know, I don't know if you can say it underperformed because it's a Coen brothers movie. But the quote from the Universal Domestic Distribution Chief, Nick Carpo, said, I'm encouraged by the result.
Yes, I was just going to say that. I like that you put that in there. It's not, I am absolutely elated. This is fantastic news. It's exactly what we expected. It's a great big, I'm encouraged by the result. It sounds right. It sounds like Donald Trump after an Iowa caucus.
I don't know how much faith to put in Cinema Score. Do the people in the industry care about the Cinema Score? To me, it just seems so, it's almost always A-B+, A-B+.
Yeah, it's like one of those things where the big question about the Cinema Score is constantly, does anybody care about the Cinema Score?
And yet here we are mentioning it because when it has an extreme like this, it had a C- Cinema Score, which is like worse than most crappy horror films.
Yeah.
So the people who went to see this movie not knowing it was an oddball comb were like, what the hell is this? They hated it.
I'm actually impressed, though, that you were able to pronounce Nick Carpo's last name.
Did I?
Yes. I was thinking, oh, he's going to try and pronounce the O. Oh, he actually did a fairly decent job.
Well, I stopped watches right twice a day. Hollywood Reporter, I think it was, had this note. They mentioned the Big Lebowski in 1998. They said it opened on 1,207 screens, and they said that was not a wide release.
I wonder if at that time period, it was considered a wide release, and that now every movie opening on 4,000 screens, it's not considered a wide release. I wonder about that.
I mean, that's 20 years ago almost.
Yes.
And they're just saying they're listing the big best openings for a Coen brothers movie in a wide release. And they say, well, Lebowski opened to 5.5 million, but come on, it only played on 1,200 screens. I'm like, that's a wide release to me. Frankly, that's a wide release even today because you can make $60, $70, $80, $100 million on 1,200 screens.
Not really, but you can make a lot of money.
Of course you can. They've done it.
I'd like to see you
Don't you make most of your money on, like, isn't it weighted towards the big screens? And that
yes,
like,
it is. It's weighted towards
you don't need those extra 2,000 screens. They're just add-ons.
No, you probably make a good 60% of your money on a smaller percentage of the screens, yes. But they're very specific to theaters and markets.
Well, Lionsgate cares about big openings, and they didn't get it for The Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 2. They had an earnings report, and people weren't happy with what they heard. They said Part 2 underperformed, and their stock fell 32%.
And so what they're doing is they are taking the board of Lionsgate, and they're bringing them to, like, an island where they will have to actually fight one another to the death to figure out who's going to remain.
But first of all, why would it fall now? I mean, haven't you already known what the movie's made? And secondly, did it really underperform? That's just what I don't get. They split it up into two movies. Yes, it cost $285 million to make those two movies, which is probably about $100 million more than it would have cost if they'd made just one movie. But, you know, they spent $285 million and they made $1.3 billion.
I guess they're looking at, yeah, I mean, I don't know what their problem is.
I think everybody's wrong here. I think Lionsgate was wrong long term to split the movie up into two. You know, I think it hurts the franchise if they think they're going to make prequels or a theme park and, you know, want to do other things with the movie, that it doesn't help you to stretch out a movie that should be done in one into two. But I also think the investors are stupid to think this movie underperformed. You know, they spent an extra $100 million to make it. And instead of making, you know, $800 million, $900 million, they made $1.3 billion. You know, it was a good investment.
Well, do you think that Deadpool is a good investment? That opens this week opposite Zoolander 2 and How to Be Single, starring Rebel Wilson.
That Deadpool, you know, great reviews. I mean, I have no particular interest in this. I don't really care for Ryan Reynolds. I couldn't believe he was in a Super Bowl ad as Mr. Hunkity Hunk.
Yes.
You know, women can't even drive a car because Ryan Reynolds is so hot. Well, okay. But this is a hard R movie and really positive reviews from the trades. They were like, this is it. This is great. People ready to make fun of superhero movies. Here's a superhero movie that does it.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it now.
I think it's going to have, I assume it will have a modester. It won't have a huge opening, but it'll have good word of mouth and have good legs.
I had no intention of seeing this movie, but now actually do want to see it.
Well, there you go. Everybody wanted to see Inside Out, of course, and that, to no surprise, dominated the Annie Awards, didn't it?
It did, actually. The Annie Awards are given out for, you know, animated films, thus the name Annie. Although there's another reason for that name, but we'll not get into that now. So Pixar actually dominated like 75% of the categories in which they were eligible. They won. They actually, I think, what was it? They were...
Was it all Pixar? There was no Disney non-Pixar stuff
going on? Well, Disney was nominated in 24 categories, including 5 for Disney TV Animation and 2 for ILM. And they took home 75 awards. I guess they won 10 awards.
75%.
Yes.
They won, and you're getting this. You're confusing everything.
That is absolutely correct. I am confusing everything.
In your notes, it says Disney won 18 of 31 possible awards.
That's true. Inside Out won 10 awards. That's what it won. Including the top prize
for
feature film.
It's all Disney. Why are you confusing things? Pixar is Disney.
I'm just saying Inside Out.
Well, you could say Inside Out alone, but don't say Pixar. It's the same company.
Okay, fine. So Inside Out won 10 awards, including the top prize for feature film.
And Disney won another 8 on top of that.
Correct.
So it was a big winner.
Yes, it was a big winner. Now, of course, that begs the question of, gee, how are people... You know, actually voting based on merit, or are they being swayed by outside?
It's one of the most acclaimed movies of the year. It should have been up for Best Picture.
Right now,
I personally didn't love it, but you know, given all the outside metrics, the massive commercial and critical acclaim, that movie should have been nominated for Best Picture.
Right now, of course, a couple of years ago, Kung Fu Panda won all of these awards, and Disney said, that's it, we're not participating in the Annies anymore. You know, it's just like, they're not merit-based, they're just going based on, you know, these...
Kung Fu Panda was a very good movie.
And so, you know, they pulled out of the Annies. And now, of course, the same thing happened. Disney, on the other hand, is at the receiving end. So I guess they like it when it happens to them.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's just sad. Who did Kung Fu Panda beat?
I have no idea. Why are you asking me this question?
Just trying to mess with you.
Okay.
That's it. It beat out Wall-E, I believe.
Okay. Yeah, right. That was a surprise, actually, that year. That was a surprise.
But Kung Fu Panda was a very good movie, too.
Yes, although Wall-E was it's a classic.
I like Wall-E a lot, but I think it has little problems in its second half.
That is absolutely correct. Yes, I agree.
I love when you agree. Right, so that's one awards thing. No surprise, Inside Out will win the Oscar for Best Animated Film, but who will win Best Director and Best Picture?
I think it's going to go to The Revenant. I really do. I think it's, last week we had, the Big Short, the week before
that.
Yeah,
I don't know why you think you know.
Because,
Producers Guild said The Big Short, SAG said Spotlight, and the Directors Guild has given their top award to The Revenant. It's as open-ended as it gets.
Yes, it is, actually, because nobody's agreeing on anything. Kind of like Hollywood itself. Nobody agrees on anything.
They agree they like to make money.
That's true.
And they agree they love to award directors multiple awards. Spielberg has won the DGA 3 times, but not for the movies he should have. Many directors have won the DGA twice, but Iñárritu is the first to win it back to back.
Yes, one after the other.
So that's very exciting. The most recent one to do it were Ang Lee and Clint Eastwood. They both won it 2 times, though not in a row. So, and for documentary, of course, Cartel Land got a boost. So if the Oscar voting is not done, that might prod a few people to look at the film that Sperling said, I believe, would win Best Documentary.
Well, I said it really deserves to, because I don't think anybody... I mean, that was a very good documentary made in a way that was incredibly real, and the guy put his life at risk. I don't know if he knew he was putting his life at risk at the time, but it was it's fascinating.
Now, actors often, when you give a great speech like Tom Hanks did at the Golden Globes, people said, oh, they want to hear that speech at the Oscars. Before everyone saw every speech 27 times, the people in the industry, when they fell in love with an actor and the way they embraced the role and the part in the industry, you can sometimes argue that, they loved that speech and that helped them win. And when they're not gracious or they're dicky, that hurts them a little bit. And they're like, well, if you're going to be a schmuck, I don't want to vote for you. I think Iñárritu perhaps helped put his film over the top, both for film and director, by his speech at the DGA.
In what
way? It was like lined up with the of the moment diversity in Hollywood. I mean, he's Mexican-born director. He was very moved, of course, to win twice in a row. Why wouldn't he be? And he talked about visiting the hotel kitchen. He said, where, quote, there were more than 120 Mexicans that serve you hot food, and that was the best party I ever had. And that's not the people that Donald Trump has described at all, end quote. And he said, this hug, this embrace you're giving to me today is going to a whole country, a whole Latin American community in this country. The people who live here contribute a lot to this country. It was a big, moving speech. It patted Hollywood on the back. Look how wonderful you are for giving me this award. You're recognizing Latino people. And I think it may be what sort of helped him, get ahead at the Oscars.
I think so, too. I also think that...
I don't think it was calculated, but I think, they just went, oh, it was a great speech.
I also think that when it comes to Oscars, they tend to sometimes award an effort. Like, this whole thing where everybody knows how hard this movie was.
He drove the crew to the breaking point, is what they wrote. I mean, give me a break. They made a movie. They did not save the world, They make it sound, oh, my God. It's like he's whipping the crew and going, go, go, mush, mush, no. And people are crying and weeping. It was not Fitzcarraldo. It was just a movie.
Well, I'm just saying.
Breaking point. I was like, oh, for God's sake. Yeah, I'm tired of that. But anyway, I think the only surprise at the Oscars would be a sweep.
Yes.
And it could do it. Picture, director, actor, screenplay.
Maybe, yeah.
Cinematography. I mean, The Revenant could sweep. And that to me would be a shocker, because this seems like a wide open year. And you would hope or expect or think that would mean a wide open race where different movies win different awards. But we'll see. I'm still voting for the Spotlight. I'm still picking the Spotlight to win.
That would be an upset, I think.
There's no such thing as an upset this year. There's no front runner.
Okay.
What we know, right? There's no front runner.
There's no front runner, but
you
I think...
You can't have a different winner of a guild every week and say there's a front runner.
That's true.
And you can for actor. DiCaprio's the front runner.
Yes.
Actress, I don't think so. There's no front runner particularly, I guess. Brie Larson.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well. So that's the awards. We'll be watching it on TV, and a lot of you may DVR it and then fast forward so you can watch it quicker.
I don't know who would ever do such a thing.
Well, apparently people don't. There are people who watch, they claim people DVR stuff and then just let the commercials run because they like the little break. I have to constantly tell my friend Zoe, who I'm like, go fast forward, go. We're wasting time. I hate commercials. I don't want to watch them. Sorry about that.
Except but during the Super Bowl, I watched a few.
They missed an episode of The Good Wife, whose last season, by the way, is coming up. But they missed an episode of The Good Wife and didn't post it right away wherever it gets posted. It's not a Hulu show because it's CBS.
That's right. CBS is not a part of Hulu.
Wherever they post it online, they failed for a week to post it. It was not there when it should have been, at least according to my friend. And when it finally did pop up, they had no commercials. And she thought maybe it was a way of apologizing, saying, sorry about that. Sorry you had to wait a week. When they got up that episode that she'd somehow missed taping for various conflicts, I think Grease Live was on. And so, you know, she wanted to catch up and it wasn't there and it popped up later than it should have. And as a thank you or apology, they kept off the commercials.
Well, if Time Warner has its way, not Time Warner Cable, they are different. Okay. Time Warner would like all shows not to be posted the next day. They want you to wait not only, a week, but like maybe until the end of the season.
Because they make their money off shows in syndication or in reruns, or why is there bugaboo about this? I mean, because if there are ads embedded, people are making money.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. That is true. You're absolutely right, Michael. Time Warner Inc., okay, they own...
Yes, we got it. We got HBO, TBS, CNN, TNT, the CW, that conglomerate.
And they make a lot of money from retransmission fees. Retransmission fees paid by cable companies like Comcast or Time Warner Cable or Charter or, Liberty. And, of course, they get a per-subscriber fee. Now, if those subscribers start to decline because they have an option of seeing that content somewhere else, well, then their revenues fall. Time Warner Inc.'s revenues will
fall.
But
that's why they want ads embedded in them on Hulu and elsewhere.
They will not make
if the people flock there, you make the money that way.
They will not make nearly as much money. And there will be, of course, a period of time where there's some crossover. And again, it's this analog dollars for digital dimes. Their fear is that the rate transmission fees will be higher than the ad revenue that they could garner from streaming.
But they can't turn back time.
No, they can't turn back time.
The VCR was invented. They have to deal with the fact that this is how people consume television. And frankly, if you want someone to catch up on a show and say, oh, I want to watch Crazy Ex-Girlfriend on the CW. You know what? I'm telling people left and right, watch this show. It's getting better every week. It's a weird, oddball, crazy little musical comedy, and I'm really loving it. It's my favorite new show on TV. It's the only new network show I'm watching. I'm telling people to watch it and catch up. If they don't have somewhere to go to watch up the first 5, 7, 8 episodes, guess what? They're out of the loop. They're not going to do it.
That's true. And now...
This is the world we live in. This is what people want. Time Warner cannot pretend it doesn't exist.
Now, Time Warner is in talks, according to the Wall Street Journal, has been in talks for the past several months to purchase a 25% stake in Hulu. And part of what they would like to see, and this is one of the sticking points, is...
No, it's not a sticking point. They say they were going to do it anyway, but it's not a sticking point, they say.
Okay.
They say, we're going to invest. We would like this to happen, but we're going to invest anyway.
Okay. Well, they would like to see all current season episodes off of Hulu. I would say, okay.
Why do you want to invest in Hulu?
Yes. Why?
It has no reason for being other than that. They have a few original shows, but they have the Stephen King miniseries coming up. They do the Mindy Project. I'm sure they will come up with a signature show that people love at some point and become a destination as much for original, but they're not even close to that yet. They're the place you go to watch current season episodes of Fox, NBC, ABC, and big cable networks.
Yeah, I hear this, I read this, I think, well, so you want to invest in it so you can kill it?
Right. That seems to be, they say, ultimately, we want you to stop that. And of course, they'll have a play if they own it, but why would you want to spend hundreds of millions of dollars investing in a company that you want to denude of its whole purpose for being?
Yeah, it's not a very innovative solution to a problem, that's for sure. It's not very forward-thinking. It's very... status quo. It's a fearful way to make a business decision.
Well, it works if you can quash something and keep it from happening, but it won't work. In this case, you'll ruin your value of Hulu, and Fox and NBC and ABC will slowly sell off their here, buy my piece, and then they'll go off and do their current season episodes elsewhere.
Yeah, I'd like to actually write the headlines now for this, how this plays out if Time Warner does this. It's called the music industry, actually. So Time Warner go see the music industry and find out what they did, what happened to them when they tried to prevent people from accessing their content.
The sooner you let people use technology to do what they want and make as much money as you can off of it, the better you'll be. So, pretending it's not happening, it doesn't work.
All right. Well, do you think it will actually happen? Do you think Time Warner is going to buy in?
They're apparently going to invest, so I think it's a big deal, especially since they're going to threaten exactly what Hulu is.
Wait, you said it's a big deal? Well, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Now, some guy speaking at some investors conference casually mentions that Amazon is going to open hundreds of bookstores. No, he doesn't speak for Amazon necessarily, but that didn't stop the media from a feeding frenzy. Others note that Amazon has indeed posted some job openings for people to run bookstores, specifically in San Diego, though it could be for one store or 100 stores. Who knows? Others say Amazon might be opening all sorts of stores, not just bookstores. After all, they've paid for all those distribution centers. Why not use them? Amazon, as always, remains mum. And for those of you who, you know, where English is a first language, that means mute.
Or a second language.
Yeah, I tried to make a joke.
Big
deal or big whoop.
Sorry. It's a big whoop for the moment because nothing's happened. I mean, this guy, a CEO of a shopping mall company.
Well, it's a big, you know, in the defense of this story, the guy's, you know, he is one of the heads of one of the biggest retail shopping mall.
Yeah, he's like, they're doing this. But he didn't realize he was making news. He wasn't trying to make news. So it was kind of a whoops moment. Like, suddenly everybody's like, what? And he's like, And it's true. From what people report, Amazon's retail store initiative is being led by Steve Kessel,
yes,
who was the guy who led the Kindle and is a big Amazon executive who left the company, is coming back now. Jeff Bezos is, you know, very close to him. And, you know, he's really well-respected. And he's come back after a sabbatical, and he's in charge of this. So it can happen. It could happen. It might happen. But we also had the 2 years where they were going to open up a store in Manhattan, and that didn't happen. Right?
No, they have one store. They have one store now in Seattle.
Right. They have a store in Seattle. Whether they're going to open hundreds, whether there'll be bookstores, nobody knows. It's interesting. And, you know, who knows what kind of store it'll be. But, you know, golly.
Well, and the guy had to release publish a press release the following day saying, well, look, I was just kind of speaking hypothetically here. I wasn't actually, yeah, come on, guys. You know, I was saying,
Leave me alone.
Yeah. But, you know, when somebody like that does say something, you know, you assume he has inside information, given that his space would have to be leased. So, you know.
And I wonder what their play is or what they think they're going to do. I guess they say there's, you know, probably they've got 40% of the population with Amazon Prime or online shopping in Amazon, and they say, well, that means 60% of the population isn't doing it.
Yeah, well, they're also
doing it easier for them, and we can do it cheaply. I guess we will.
Yeah, it's also for showcasing. We know you're going to come in here and look at the TVs and then go home and order it online from Amazon. That's fine, because we either sold it to
you. Best Buy is going out of business.
Yeah,
we got to showcase them somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
That's assuming they do electronics and other things.
Is the show Orange is the New Black, Michael, a comedy or a drama?
I don't know.
Well, guess what? You have three more seasons to figure it out. In a bold move, more typical of a daytime talk show, Netflix has renewed the hit series for three more seasons and made sure the show's creator, Jenji Kohan, would remain on board as well. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It's practically the first prime time. Is that what we say for this? First major TV show to get a three-year renewal. We've had it in reality. We've had it in daytime talk shows. I don't believe we've ever had a primetime show like a major show like this get a 3 year, 2 years. Yes. But 3 years, I think, is new territory. It's smart, right? Lock everybody in, let them map out the series, let them map out what they want to do. But it doesn't reflect reality, does it? Because we've got all this prison reform and they're going to let people out early release and all that sort of stuff.
Well, you know, just because they let people out doesn't mean you can't follow them.
Or put new people in.
I mean, Beverly Hills 90210 was about, you know, rich kids in Beverly Hills High
College.
School. They went to college. Right, exactly. Glee was about an a cappella group in high school. They followed
them. They should have not gone to college.
That's true. They should have been held back.
They should have gone to a new class. But anyway.
Matt LeBlanc, one of the stars of the sitcom Friends back in the 90s and early aughts, is a gearhead who loves cars. So he's a surprising but immediately logical choice to be one of the new hosts of Top Gear, the massively successful worldwide hit show about cars that lost its previous host after one too many close calls with controversy and bad behavior off camera. Currently, LeBlanc has been starring in the BBC Showtime series Episodes, whose fifth season begins filming soon. Maybe they'll move the action to London so LeBlanc can kill two birds with one stone. He's not just a fan. LeBlanc has been on the show, Top Gear, as a guest and holds the record for fastest time around the track in a modestly priced car. I love the qualifier on that.
Well, because they got different things. They got going around the track in a, you know, in a racing car and a Maserati and in a Prius, you know.
Well, big deal or big whoop.
It's a big deal because this is a massive worldwide franchise. It's a very important property for the BBC. They're going to have competition with the original, not the original, but the host who left. They're going to be doing their own version somewhere else. I forget who it is now.
Amazon.
Is it Amazon?
I think so.
Wow. Yeah. So that makes perfect sense. And so it's, you know, Matt LeBlanc, I mean, you can't say Cheers. I mean, Friends isn't a hugely popular show in the US, but I swear, I think it's even more popular in the UK.
Just in time for Chinese New Year, ESPN is learning Mandarin. The sports brand has I was just going to say, Gong Ho Hoi Fat Choi, right? I mean, I'm going to find out that's Cantonese, I'm sure. The sports brand
Mandarin, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The sports brand has just struck a deal with China's Tencent. That online site has hundreds of millions of users that follow sports online via its services. ESPN will start to feed its coverage of major sports to them, beginning with unique basketball and European soccer stories in Mandarin, as well as repurposing their coverage of other sports. They'll provide ESPN analysts for Tencent's coverage of the NBA playoffs. Tencent also owns WeChat. That's their texting microblogging platform, a lot like Twitter, and other media sites that will buy into promoting the sports content. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I mean, this, I guess it's not, but as a reflection again of the black hole pool of China, when you're talking about the world economy and business, like you want to be in business, there's a lot of money to be made there. You better learn Mandarin.
The Birmingham Symphony Orchestra in the UK has snagged a new conductor. Now, Michael, let's get ready for this one.
Yeah.
It's the 29-year-old Lithuanian Mirga Graznita Tila. Mirga Graznita Tila. Michael and I spent probably 5 minutes before we started taping trying to get the pronunciation correct. Of course, here
I say we should just immediately pull a Cher and just, we're going to call her Mirga from now on.
Mirga.
One name. That's all she needs. Mirga.
Actually, what's funny is in Los Angeles, that's exactly how she's known.
I'm sure.
Because currently, she's the assistant conductor of the LA Philharmonic. She has proven a real draw. She's young, female, and of course, talented. It's just the latest sign of how the classical world is a truly global community. Need more proof? Benjamin Millepied is stepping down from the Paris Ballet. He's a world-famous French dancer and choreographer who became known to the rest of us after working on the Hollywood movie Black Swan and marrying the movie star Natalie Portman, who has dual citizenship in the U.S. and Israel. The glitzy Millepied butted heads with everyone at the staid Paris Ballet, and his departure is very mutual indeed. Big deal or big whoop?
It's all a big whoop. I guess it's cool to see a female conductor breaking down some barriers. We'll have to see how she does in Birmingham.
Yeah, I think, you know, look, she is...
They'll love her,
yeah. I mean, Mirga is kind of one of those people, you see a picture of her and you're like, oh, I get it. Okay, she's this, you know...
You're sexist, but
she's
attractive. Good conductor, right?
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, she's... Yes, however, there's lots of good conductors out there. Why is she any more pressworthy than, say, somebody
else? Believe me. Classical music, when you see, the hottest new young violinist, they're never ugly.
Yes, that is true.
Man or woman, you don't see ugly, you know, it's just the way the world works, sadly.
Now, speaking of seeing things, during the halftime show, there was a lot of press about this, and then it kind of was overlooked or kind of, you know, was a passing glance during the halftime show yesterday, that Gustavo Dudamel, who is the LA Philharmonic's musical director and of course works with Mirga, he was going to conduct the Youth Orchestra of Los Angeles during the halftime show with Coldplay. YOLA is the name of this orchestra, and they were there, but you could barely tell. He was like on somebody's shoulders conducting the whole thing. Like, they basically panned the camera past him.
What'd you expect?
I don't know.
You thought he was going to take a bow?
Pretty much, yeah.
It's Coldplay, Beyonce, and Bruno Mars. He's lucky to be there. I thought you were going to mention the fact that Beyonce stormed the field of the Super Bowl with the Black Panthers. I mean, my God, you know we're in Obama's America. I mean, the heads of the last four remaining members of the KKK must have exploded during. Not only did it happen and she's singing how she loves the Jackson 5 nostrils, meaning black beauty and, you know, black is beautiful. But like nobody said anything or cared. You know, that's what's kind of amazing about it.
Yeah, no, I thought the halftime show was quite well done yesterday.
Yeah.
Oh,
not,
my goodness.
Not so much, but whatever. It's usually a mess.
Japanese broadcasters are making a move against the recording of TV shows. They plan to insert a quote-unquote do not record tag on all 4K and 8K programming.
I now reference our previous story about Time Warner Inc. and Hulu.
Yes. This is what is technically known as a broadcast flag, which all receivers would be expected to obey. Taping of daytime soaps and much of TV is a deeply entrenched practice in Japan, perhaps even more so than in the U.S., and there's been a big outcry. However, with the implementation of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, copyright holders gain significant new powers, and something like this new legislation might actually be enforceable. Big deal or big whoop?
It's big stupid is what it is.
You know what this is? You really want to know what's happening here, I think?
I do.
Is that 4K?
That's why I'm here.
4K and 8K. Okay, 8K programming. First of all, I don't know anybody broadcasting 8K programming.
Well, they're planning for the future.
Right.
We're going to we want you to buy a big fat new screen and have it be less useful.
8K programming when it's not broadcast, so when it's actually native and, you know, it's, you know, from a device that's attached to the television, looks stunning. I don't know what they would do to compress it to get it broadcast. But 4K is broadcast worthy. I mean, you can actually broadcast. Well, you can broadcast 8K, too. You just have to compress it a lot more.
Uh-huh.
The problem is that 4K and 8K natively is what masters are done in. Okay? So what
they're worried it's too good a quality.
Yeah, I think what they're
worried. But nobody cares. First of all, nobody cares. The quality is just fine the way it is now. So, like, the idea that there's going to be more piracy. It's like they're already happy to steal everything already.
Yeah, that's true.
You know? And in fact, with audio, it became more valuable the more compressed it was and the less high quality it was because it was easier to download.
That's right.
You know, it's just asinine. It's just the idea that you could put in a new restrict people's right to record, which they have at least in North America. I don't know the laws in Japan, but yes, you have a right to time shift. You have a legal right to do that. And the idea you can say, well, this is a new technology, therefore you lose that basic right is absurd.
There are broadcast flags in North America and specifically in the U.S. where they could make it so that you can't fast forward through commercials. But nobody's actually, very few times have.
Because we would take our cable box and break it over their heads.
Yes. And as we know, now we can actually, you know, if the FCC passes that new legislation.
Buy our own new cable box.
That's right. So we always
try to cover stories from around the world. We don't always succeed because obviously our wheelhouse is film. You know, we do a lot there.
Film and television,
Pretty good, big deal, big look. Germany, France, the UK, Spain, you know, pretty good. We got Japan. We got all over the place this time.
And in fact, if you have a story that you think we should be covering, please write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And let us know. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And we will actually, you know, we read the email, we listen to the voicemails, and very often we'll include stories that are suggested to us. Now,
and maybe Sherry Redstone will call us and leave a message explaining, awkward week at Viacom.
Yes, in fact, that is our story for Inside Baseball this week. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, Sumner Redstone, who is 92 years old and in poor health, facing a medical exam to determine his competency. And, you know, he's got lawsuits from the left and lawsuits from the right. You know, I think a lot of people wondered what was going to happen if he were to pass away or if
when. I mean, you know, he's not immortal.
Yeah, it's never easy when the king is fading. Bowing to reality, Redstone resigned from his position as chairman of CBS and Viacom, with Leslie Moonves officially taking over at CBS after daughter Sherry Redstone publicly announced it wasn't a good idea for Philip DeMann to take over Viacom. He did just that. Oops. Big deal or big whoop.
Well, it's
actually Big Deal or Big Whoop. I don't know what I'm
baseball now.
Yeah.
This is interesting. It was, you know, like on Wednesday, she's like, it's not a good idea because he is on the board of the trust overseeing the shares that Sumner Redstone controls. And when he dies, that trust will be in power to oversee that trust and what's happening with the control he has in the companies. And she felt it was a conflict to be the head of Viacom and sitting on the board of that trust.
Right.
And so she's like, I don't think it's a good idea for him to be on both. And then the next day he's like, I'm in charge.
Yeah.
So that has to be an awkward board meeting. The next time that happened.
Yeah. And this was right after you had Philip DeMann saying, hey, I got this really, you know, huge pay decrease this year because what? You filed something and you now know that I actually got a 50% raise while the stock price is off 42%. Okay. Big mistake. I mean, here he is getting criticized for taking a huge raise when the stock price is falling. And then the next week, this is what happens.
Yes.
So not very wise. And this is actually headed for a bit of a, I think.
Well, he may step down from the trust.
Yes.
Or whatever. You know, that seems the most likely fix to keep everybody happy and to shut him up and to stay in power where it matters the most. Obviously one easy solution.
And there's been some talk about Sherry Redstone wanting to be the chairman herself. And
well,
why,
of course, why not?
Yeah. And so, you know, I think that's where the conflict lies. DeMann is Sumner Redstone's kind of protege, so to speak.
Well, he was, and then he became closer to Sherry in the last few years as his health was fading, unfortunately. So maybe he would have made a new change, but that's just not possible anymore.
But all this talk about, well, gee, Sumner Redstone is maybe not capable of running the company, or, you know, he's...
Well, clearly he's not day-to-day or involved in any particular way.
Right, but
he's not even attending annual conferences anymore.
Right, but that he may not be of sound mind, so to speak, or sound competency to run the company, when all of a sudden a doctor's going to show up to judge that, oh, well, this is what happens.
Then they make the move, yeah, yeah, exactly. Not that that doesn't still have to happen, because that involves a lawsuit, but yeah, they finally had to act. And then one of the lawsuits is saying, hey, you've been paying this guy tens of millions of dollars to do stuff he's not actually doing.
Right.
So that means turmoil for Viacom, doesn't it? I mean, this isn't over.
Yeah.
This is not a smooth transition. And that can create problems. Who's in charge? Who do you put your weight behind? If somebody greenlights your movie, are they going to be, or TV show, are they there tomorrow to make sure it goes through?
Yeah. I mean, this was part of the problem with Paramount Pictures to begin with, was that they didn't have any films last year. And this year it's, you know, looking kind of lean. And the films they do have, they have to do well.
And you've been talking to people who see similar turmoil at Warner Brothers. They've had two very down years, of course, at the box office. And I would look at their upcoming slate of the next 2 years and say they're going to be just fine. They're going to be back on top. And people are going to say, hey, Warner Brothers made a turnaround. I mean, people always have ups and downs. But my perspective is just looking at the box office and at the upcoming release schedule. You talk to people who say, yeah, you know what? It's hard to get a straight answer from Warner Brothers. Isn't that what you hear?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's more of a management organizational structure
issue.
Well,
yeah, that's what's going to happen. Well, the turmoil is caused by different factors, but the result of confusion and who's in charge and what's going to happen is the same.
Yeah, that's Warner Brothers Pictures, by the way. Not necessarily, Warner Brothers Television as well, but... that's basically the way it was set up, and the whole bake-off between the three heads of the divisions. They think it's just kind of, it gutted the company of management, and it's taking some time to right itself.
Well, I wonder if that perceived, muddiness at Warner Brothers is spilling over to HBO. Does that even make any sense? It should be its own fiefdom, and it should be, have its own ups and downs or problems. And certainly they're not hurting. I mean, they've got Games of Thrones, the biggest hit in their history. They've got Girls, which is coming to an end and certainly has critical acclaim. They got John Oliver doing, giving them kudos left and right. Martin Scorsese directed the pilot of their new show, Vinyl, and that's in his wheelhouse of 1970s rock and roll. So there's a lot of good things going on at HBO. But I don't know. There's been a lot of projects in the last year and a half that seem to be in confused turmoil.
Well, I think a part of that is before, if you had a project, where'd you go? You had a project that you kind of a high value television project. It wasn't necessarily, a feature film or going to be a theatrical release, but it was, production value, big budget, esteem project. Where are you going to bring it? Well, HBO, Showtime, that's probably it. Now you've got HBO, Showtime, Netflix, Amazon. You could go to a number of places.
Well, they've got a lot more competition, but that doesn't explain why when they have a project and they land it and they are making it, why problems would occur then. You know, delivering through on the shows that they have. They had David Fincher signed up for two shows in the works, and he's given up and gone back to Netflix. True Detective was a show that they launched a great first season, and then they seem to have just screwed the pooch with that one, and they've seemed to have killed that franchise, you know, in
its
the cradle.
Yeah.
Right now, with Westworld, this is this, you know, reboot of a movie. I don't even know why anyone wants to make this as a series. I don't know how it's going to work, but hey, I'm ready to watch it and see what they got going. But they've had this in the works. It's a big, high-profile project. They started filming, and they shut down in mid-production so they could figure out the ending. That's a big mess. And now the same thing, if not worse, has happened with Lewis and Clark. This is a miniseries based on, I believe, the Stephen Ambrose book Undaunted Courage, but I'm not actually sure about that. Maybe it's just based on the public record. But it's a big, high-profile miniseries. It comes from Tom Hanks producing, who's got a great track record with HBO, with Band of Brothers, and lots of other things. It stars Casey Affleck, who's about to be as hot as he's ever going to be with this movie Manchester by the Sea. He's going to be an Oscar contender. So it's great timing. And they've stopped production again. They dumped the director and the DP midstream, and now they stopped it after filming, you know, hours of footage. They've got multiple episodes done, and now they're going back to rework the script. I mean, that's crazy. It happens once, all right, and it happens in animated movies, but Westworld and Lewis and Clark and messing up True Detective and David Fincher walking away. To me, it sounds like HBO's got a lot of problems.
Well, okay, let's look at this for a second, because usually when this happens at a network or a studio, you can look at the development executives. Yes.
You know.
And so, but there's always this lag. It's never, well, something happened immediately and we can pin it to something. It's usually 2 years prior.
Or so, even something good.
Yes,
like
correct.
Susan Lyne is at ABC. She was my boss at Premiere Magazine. Not that she ever knew my name, but you know, I worked there. She went on to ABC and headed them and launched Desperate Housewives and Lost, but they fired her after one season. So before those shows could hit the air and make glory, she was gone.
Right. But, and of course, whoever took over for her got all the credit. Meanwhile,
right.
was that, yeah. Now, here's what happened in October of 2013. You had two folks promoted at HBO, Casey Bloys and Michael Ellenbergs. They were going to head up both, you know, comedy and drama series. Okay. So that's what happened there. So that's,
but that makes a perfectly sensible breakdown of responsibility, though.
Yes, it does. And then, you know, 2 years later, though, you have
the drama guy fired and the comedy guy taken over.
That's right. Correct. Because that happened just last week or a week
ago.
That's
right. We reported on it.
Okay. So that's
Casey is in charge now, right? What's his name?
Casey Bloys?
Yes. He's in charge now, right?
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if Michael Lombardo is still there.
I don't know. So that means, so you're saying, hey, so what happened last week was the culmination of several years of problems. And with all these things in turmoil, they felt like it wasn't happening and they had to make a change.
Yeah. And Michael Lombardo is still at HBO and he took the blame for True Detective season two.
Did he write the scripts?
No, but I think, you know, you oversee it. So, you know,
it's hard to second guess the creatives when they've just had a first season like that.
Yeah.
So you're saying 2 years ago when they named what's his name is drama, it hasn't worked out so well. And now they've already made a change. So maybe they can hope that 2 years from now, they'll have a better track record in drama.
Possibly, yeah. Or he's taking the fall for it. That's for sure.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And also taking a fall, sadly, is Maurice White.
I cannot believe the way we move into obituaries every single... We are setting new lows for how we move into obituaries. Maurice White is the founder of Earth, Wind, and Fire. He passed away. He died at the age of 74.
Yeah, you know, we've been trying to sort of pull back on obituaries and just talk about them when we have something useful to say. And I don't know that we do have something useful to say, except what a fascinating, weird group, Earth, Wind, and Fire. They came from the jazz world in a way, and they just put everything in there, jazz and funk and horns and stuff you hadn't seen in rock and roll and pop music in ages. And somehow the whole melange became pop music. You know, and I don't quite know how they do it, but it's so distinctive. You know Earth, Wind, and Fire the second you hear them. And a great string of singles and a couple great, great albums.
And when you read Maurice White's biography or his obituary, and you kind of see, wow, he was like a jazz drummer and a jazz musician, and he somehow managed to put this whole group together and it turned into like a funk, pop, rock, you know, R&B
extravaganza.
Band.
Yes,
yeah, it's
exactly.
Like pretty remarkable.
It's kind of like what the Bruno Mars thing now, you know, when you've got just that you feel like everything is in the stew.
Well, yeah, that's actually a pretty good analogy. In fact, if you like our analogies or if you don't like our analogies or if you like the stories we covered or maybe not even like this, we want to hear from you is what I'm trying to say. Send us your comments, your feedback, your love, your praise. There's ways to do this. As I mentioned before, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also leave us some, I don't know, reviews on any one of these podcast aggregators.
Or more importantly, get your assistant to rate and review our show.
That's true. You know,
you're busy. Get your assistant to do it.
Yeah. Yes. You know, look, we know we have a lot of high power executives who are listening to the show. Who, you know, a lot of development execs, a lot of comedy execs, as you just mentioned, they listen to the show and they're too busy. Okay, we get it. They have time to listen, not to rate and review. So you know what? Assistants. That's who we're talking to now. Go to iTunes, go to the Microsoft Marketplace, go to Stitcher, go to wherever they give podcasts away for free and rate and review the show. It does help us out, and we truly do appreciate it when you do that. All of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode, ways to subscribe to the show, ways to contact us, ways to follow us. We're on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle. Or we're on Facebook. You can search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's savehulu.com.
Oh, okay.
Well, lethulubehulu.com.
Okay, well, if you can't find any of Michael's writing about the entertainment industry or coverage of the entertainment industry on any of those websites, why don't you try heading on over to, I don't know, michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated, and you can also read him on the Huffington Post, or you can head on over to bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.